Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, I ended on a discussion about the collapse of the 300-year-old Ponzi scheme. The bubble has and will definitely burst. The wheel started flying off the banker's money machine in July of 2007, just after the book, The Web of Debt, was published. The Fed and the plunge protection team did their best to keep the curtain drawn while they frantically patched together bailout schemes, but the choking and sputtering of the broken machine was too much to conceal. Sudden dramatic declines in the stock market, the housing market, and the credit market were all quite frightening to the residents of our Oz, huddled in their vulnerable thatched roof houses, but there wasn't much they could do about it. So like Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, they resolved to wait and see what the future would bring. They had long known that things were not as they seemed in the Emerald City, and the old facade had to come down before the real Emerald Isle could appear. The bubble burst and the meltdown began in earnest when investment bank Bear Stearns had to close two of its hedge funds in June of 2007. The hedge funds were trading in collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, loans that had been sliced up, bundled with less risky loans, and sold as securities to investors to induce rating agencies to give them AAA ratings, these financial products had then been insured against loss with derivative bets. The alarm bells went off when the creditors tried to get their money back. The CDOs were put up for sale, and there were no takers at anywhere near the stated valuations. Mark Gilbert, writing on Bloomberg.com, observed, quote, "The efforts by Bear Stearns creditors to extricate themselves from their investments have been laid bare, one of the derivative market's dirty little secrets. Prices are mostly generated by a confidence trick. As long as all of the participants keep a straight face when agreeing on a particular value for a security, that's the price. As soon as someone starts giggling, however, the jig is up, and the bookkeepers might have to confess to a new lower price." End quote. The secret of the Wall Street wizards was out. The derivatives game was a confidence trick, and when confidence was lost, the trick no longer worked. The $681 trillion derivatives bubble was an illusion. Panic spread around the world, and as increasing numbers of investment banks had to prevent runs on their hedge funds by refusing withdrawals from nervous customers who had bet the farm on this illusory scheme. Between July and August 2007, the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 1,000 points, prompting commentators to warn of a 1929-style crash. When the liquidity crisis became too big for the investment banks to handle, the central banks stepped in. But in this case, the crisis wasn't actually the result of a lack of money in the system. The newly created money lent to subprime borrowers was still circulating in the economy. The borrowers just weren't paying it back to the banks. Investors still had money to invest. They just weren't using it to buy AAA asset-backed securities that had toxic subprime mortgages embedded in them. The faith-based money system of the banks was frozen into illiquidity because no one was buying it anymore. The solution of the U.S. Federal Reserve, along with the central banks of Europe, Canada, Australia, and Japan, was to conjure up $315 billion in credit and extend it to troubled banks and investment firms. The rescued institutions included Countrywide Financial, the largest U.S. mortgage lender. Countrywide was being called the next Enron, not only because it was facing bankruptcy, but because it was guilty of some quite shady practices. It underwrote and sold hundreds of thousands of mortgages containing false and misleading information, which were then sold to the international banking and investment markets as securities. The lack of liquidity in the markets was blamed directly on the corrupt practices at Countrywide and other lenders of its ilk. According to one analyst, entire nations are now at risk of their economies collapsing because of this fraud. But that did not deter the U.S. Central Bank from sending in a lifeboat. Countrywide was saved from insolvency when Bank of America bought $2 billion of Countrywide stock with a loan made available by the Fed at newly reduced interest rates. Bank of America also got a windfall out of the deal, since when investors learned that Countrywide was being rescued, the stock it had just purchased with money borrowed from the Fed shot up. The market hemorrhage was bandaged over, the Dow Jones turned around, and investors breathed a sigh of relief. All was well again in Stepfordville, or so it seemed. Just as the men behind the curtain appear to have everything under control in the United States, the global credit crisis hit in England. In September 2007, Northern Rock, Britain's fifth largest mortgage lender, was besieged at branches across the country as thousands of worried customers queued for hours in hopes of getting their money out before the doors closed. It was called the worst bank run since the 1970s. Bank officials feared that as much as half the bank's deposit base could be withdrawn before the run was over. By September 14, 2007, Northern Rock's share price had dropped 30%, and on September 17th, it dropped another 35%. There was talk of a public takeover. If the run on deposits looks out of control, said one official, Northern Rock would effectively be nationalized and put into administration so it could be wound down. And I'll come back to this in a moment. For those of you just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The bloodletting slowed after the government issued an emergency pledge to Northern Rock's worried savers that their money was safe, but analysts said the credit crisis was here to stay. As BBC News explained the problem, Northern Rock has struggled since money markets seized up over the summer. The bank is not short of assets, but they are tied up in loans to homeowners. Because of the global credit crunch, it has found it difficult to borrow the cash to run its day-to-day operations. The bank was borrowing short to lend long, playing a shell game with its customers' money. While angry depositors were storming Northern Rock in England, Countrywide Financial was again quietly being snatched from the void in the United States, and this time with $12 billion in newfound financing. Financing found where? Peter Ralter wrote in LeMetropoleCafe.com on September 16, 2007, quote, "Why is it that the $2 billion investment by Bank of America in Countrywide was front page news in August, while the company's new $12 billion financing is buried on the business pages? Isn't it funny, too, that Countrywide didn't specify who is providing all that money, saying only that it comes from new or existing credit lines? There was no comment either on the credit or interest terms. This for $12 billion. It makes me suspect that Countrywide's new angle isn't the B of A, but rather the B of B, the Bank of Bernanke." Close quote. But Countrywide's downward slide continued until January 2008, when Bank of America agreed to buy it for $4.1 billion. Again, eyebrows were raised. Bank of America had just announced that it was cleaning house and cutting 650 jobs. Was the deal another bailout with money funneled from the Fed and its plunge protection team? As John Hoffel noted in 2002, major financial crises are never announced in the newspapers, but are instead treated as a form of national security secret, so that various bailouts and market manipulation activities can be performed behind the scenes. This is true in the United States, where bailouts are conducted by a private central bank answerable to other private banks. But in England, the central bank is at least technically owned by the government, warranting more transparency. The cost of that transparency, however, was that the Bank of England came under heavy public criticism for its bailout of Northern Rock. It was criticized for waiting too long and for bailing the bank out at all, emboldening other banks in their risky ventures. At one time, U.S. bailouts were also done openly through the FDIC under the auspices of Congress, but that approach cost votes. The failure of President George Bush Sr. to win a second term in office was blamed in part on the bailout of long-term capital management engineered during his first term. The public cost was all too obvious to taxpayers and the more solvent banks, which wound up paying higher FDIC insurance premiums to provide a safety net for their high-rolling competitors. As Congressman Ron Paul noted in 2005, quote, "These premiums, which are actually taxes, are the primary source of funds for the deposit insurance fund. This fund is used to bail out banks that experience difficulties meeting commitments to their depositors. Thus, the deposit insurance system transfers liability for poor management decisions from those who made the decisions to their competitors. This system punishes those financial institutions that follow sound practices as they are forced to absorb the losses of their competitors. This also compounds the moral hazard problem created whenever government socializes business losses. In the event of a severe banking crisis, Congress likely will transfer funds from general revenues into the deposit insurance fund, which would make all taxpayers liable for the mistakes of a few. Close quote. Under the Fed's new stealth bailout plan, it could avoid this sort of unpleasant scrutiny by taxing the public indirectly through inflation. No longer was it necessary to go begging to Congress for money. The Fed could just create credit with accounting entries. As Chris Powell commented on the GATA website in August 2007, quote, "In central banking, if you need money for anything, you just sit down and type some up and click it over to someone who is ready to do as you ask with it. If it works for the Federal Reserve, Bank of America, and Countrywide, it can work for everyone else. For it is no more difficult for the Fed to conjure $2 billion for Bank of America and its friends to invest in Countrywide than it would be for the Fed to wire a few thousand dollars into your checking account, calling it, say, an advance on your next tax cut or a mortgage interest rebate awarded to you because some big bad lender encouraged you to buy a McMansion with no money down in the expectation that you could flip it in a few months for enough profit to buy a regular house." Close quote. Better yet, the government itself could issue the money and use it to fund a tax-free, debt-free stimulus package spent into the economy on productive ventures such as infrastructure and public housing. A mere $188 billion would have been enough to repair all of the country's 74,000 bridges known to be defective, preventing another tragedy like the disastrous Minnesota bridge collapse seen in July of 2007. Needless to say, the $300 billion collectively extended by the central banks did not go for anything so socially useful as building bridges or roads. Rather, it went into subsidizing the very banks that had precipitated the crisis, keeping them afloat for further profligacy. The derivative iceberg began to emerge from the deep, too. Alarm bells sounded again in January of 2008 when global markets took their worst tumble since September 11, 2001. The precipitous drop was blamed on the threat of downgrades in the rating of two major mortgage bond insurers, followed by a $7.2 billion loss in derivative trades by Société Générale, France's second largest bank. The debacle was pinned on a single 31-year-old rogue trader engaging in fictitious trades. The collapse in international markets occurred on January 21, 2008, when U.S. markets were closed for Martin Luther King Day. It was bad timing. There was no Federal Reserve, no plunge protection team, no CNBC squawk box on duty to massage the market back up. If there was any lingering doubt about whether a plunge protection team actually went into action in such situations, it was dispelled by a statement by Senator Hillary Clinton reported by the State News Service on January 22, 2008. She said, quote, "I think it's imperative that the following step be taken. The president should have already, and should do so very quickly, convene the president's working group on financial markets. That's something that he can ask the Secretary of the Treasury to do. This has to be coordinated across markets with the regulators here and obviously with regulators and central banks around the world." Close quote. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The plunge protection team evidently responded to Hillary Clinton's call because the market reversed course the next day. but the curtain had been thrown back long enough to see what the future might bode. Both the French crisis and the bond insurance crisis were linked to the teetering derivatives pyramid. Market analyst Jim Sinclair called it the crime of all time, but he wasn't referring to the French debacle. He was referring to the derivative scam itself. He wrote, quote, "Default swaps and derivatives were always a scam if you consider their inability to do what they had contracted to do. All that existed was world-class, unbridled greed. The entire financial world is now threatened with a problem for which there is no practical solution, unwinding derivatives that are hell-bent on producing a financial apocalypse," close quote. And just as a footnote, a credit default swap is a form of insurance in which the risk of default is transferred from the holder of a security to the seller of the swap. The problem is that the seller of credit protection can collect premiums without proving it can pay up in the event of default, so there is no guarantee that the money will actually be there when default occurs. That the derivative scam was indeed mainly about greed was confirmed by investment guru and trading insider Jim Cramer in a televised episode on January 17, 2008. Mike Whitney, who transcribed the segment, wrote, quote, "In Cramer's last explosion, he details his own involvement in creating and selling structured products, which had never been stress-tested in a slumping market. No one knew how badly they would perform. Cramer admits that the motivation behind peddling this junk to gullible investors was simply greed." Here's his statement, quote, "It's all about the commission. We used to say the commissions on structured products are so huge, let's jam it." As an aside note, jam it means foisted on the customer. It's all about the commish. The commission on structured product is gigantic. I could make a fortune jamming that crummy paper, but I had a degree of conscience. What a shocker. We used to regulate people, but they decided during the Reagan Revolution that was bad. So we don't regulate anyone anymore. But listen, the commission in structured product is so gigantic. First of all, the customer has no idea what the product really is because it is invented. Second, you assume the customer is really stupid. Like we used to say about the German bankers. The German banks are just bozos. Throw them anything. Or the Australians, morons. Or the Florida Fund. Ha ha. They're so stupid, let's give them triple B junk grade. Then we just laugh and laugh at the customers and jam them with the commission. Remember, this is about commissions, about how much money you can make by jamming stupid customers. I've seen it all my life. You jam stupid customers. End quote. Greed has been fostered not only by the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, but by the corporate structure itself. Traders and management can hide behind the corporate shield, walking away with huge bonuses and commissions while the company is dissolved in bankruptcy. Angelo Mozzillo, the CEO of Countrywide, was expected to leave the corporation with about $50 million after virtually bankrupting the company and a horde of borrowers and investors along with it. The current unregulated environment parallels the abuses of the 1920s. Journalist Robert Kuttner testified before the House Committee on Financial Services in October 2007. Quote, "Since repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999, after more than a decade of de facto inroads, superbanks have been able to reenact the same kinds of structural conflicts of interest that were endemic in the 1920s, leading to speculators packaging and securitizing credits and then selling them off, wholesale or retail, and extracting fees at every step along the way." And much of this paper is even more opaque to bank examiners than its counterparts were in the 1920s. Much of it isn't paper at all, and the whole process is supercharged by computers and automated formulas. End quote. Unlike in the 1920s, the financial system is now precariously perched atop hundreds of trillions of dollars in derivatives dominoes, which will come crashing down when the gamblers try to cash in their bets. The betting game that was supposed to balance and stabilize markets has wound up destabilizing them because most players have bet the same way, on a continually rising market. Kuttner said, quote, an independent source of instability is that while these credit derivatives are said to increase liquidity and serve as shock absorbers, in fact, their bets are often in the same direction, assuming perpetually rising asset prices. So in a credit crisis, they can act as net destabilizers, close quote. The lenders were gambling that they could avoid liability by selling risky loans to investors, and the bond insurers were gambling that they would never have to pay out on claims. That was another of Cramer's rants. Unlike car insurers or home insurers, the all-important bond insurers did not have the money to pay up on potential claims. These were insurers that bet they would never have to pay. While media attention was focused on the French rogue trader incident, what really drove the market's plunge in late January 2008 was the downgrade by one rating agency, Fitch, of one of the monoline insurers, AMBAC, and the threatened downgrade of another, MBIA. The monolines are in the business of selling protection against bond default, lending their AAA ratings to other risky ventures. They are called monolines because regulators allow them to serve only one industry, the bond industry. That means they cannot jeopardize fire insurance or your health insurance, only the money you or your pension fund invest in safe AAA bonds. The monolines insure against default by selling credit default swaps. Basically, they insure by taking bets. Credit default swaps enable buyers and sellers to place bets on the likelihood that loans will go into default. The insurers serve as the risk counterparties, but they don't actually have to ante up in order to play. They just sit back and collect the premiums for taking the risk that some unlikely event will occur. The theory is that this spreads the risk by shifting it to those most able to pay, the insurers that collect many premiums and have to pay out on only a few claims. The theory works when the event insured against actually is unlikely. It works with fire insurance because most insurers don't experience fires. It also works with municipal bonds, which almost never default. But the monolines made the mistake of insuring corporate bonds backed by subprime mortgages. The catastrophe insured against was a collapse in the housing market, and when it occurred everywhere at once. Investments everywhere were going up in flames, spreading risk like a computer virus around the world. According to a 2005 article in Fortune magazine, MBIA claimed to have no loss underwriting. That meant it never expected or intended to have to pay out on claims. It took only safe bets. In 2002, MBIA was leveraged 139-1. It had $764 billion in outstanding guarantees and a mere $5.5 billion in equity. So how did it get its AAA rating? The rating agencies said they based their assessments on past performance, and during the boom years, there actually were very few claims. That, however, was before the housing bubble burst. Today, MBIA is being called the Enron of the insurance business. And we'll continue to uncover this in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. Speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.